So here's part two of the talk with Jonathan. In this episode, we talk about public land hunting, trophy entries from last season, as well as a quick chat about hogs and bears. Louisiana wildlife management areas within the state are commonly called WMAs. Now, the goal of these areas are to protecting, conserving, and replenishing wildlife as well as aquatic life. These WMAs may be owned or managed by the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. The Enforcement Division ensures the compliance of laws and rules and regulations according to the management of conservation, protecting the wildlife and fisheries resources, and providing public safety. Now, on the trophy side of things, the 2020-2021 season was a huge success. The wet summer helped nutritional-rich browse survive late into the year, and the antler growth seen last year was just a visual aspect of how much that nutritional boost was able to help the state's deer herd. Brennan Morris of Ravel was able to arrow an amazing animal with his crossbow in November of 2020. That gross scored 309.68 on the Buckmaster's Whitetail Trophy scoring system. My friend and scoring mentor, Buckmaster's master scorer and regional director Cecil Reddick, measured the deer's 46 scoreable points twice just to make sure that his original score was accurate. I recently heard Brennan's tale on a podcast based out of South Louisiana and was absolutely enthralled at his account of the hunt. I mentioned this podcast while talking with Jonathan. And as always, what's Louisiana hunting without hogs and bears? We chat briefly about these two ill-favored tenants of the Louisiana landscape as well. And later, I sat down with the boys from Tiger Bend Outdoors and discussed everything wild hog. The information they gave me on trapping wild hogs and getting them under control is absolutely something I'm very glad we were able to get for you guys. There's always a story, and it's my job to find it. This is the Antlers and Hicks Podcast, Episode 4, Part 2 of the Louisiana Deer Data with Jonathan Bordelon, as well as a subpart called Calling the Hogs with Tiger Bend Outdoors. Enjoy. Wildlife management areas. This is state-owned land. And like you alluded to before, you really stole one of my questions, brother. I was going to ask you about why WMAs have a different date than the rest of the state. They always have, you know, you'll have shorter hunts, you'll have bow only, can't kill bucks during certain time, you know, that kind of stuff. So you answered that already, but the data shows that, you know, WMA efforts are doing pretty good.
Yeah, the efforts per harvest are doing well. The actual efforts themselves have declined. So what we're seeing is fewer hunters in general. So there are less hunters in Louisiana than there were 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. And the WMAs haven't been immune to that. We've seen a decline in hunter numbers. But what we've also been able to do is provide additional allowances, whether it's increased days or increased either sex opportunity. We've kind of compensated for fewer hunters with more opportunity. So you're still able to arrive at harvest that area is capable of supporting. You're just arriving at it with a few more days than what you would have had to offer if you would have had a larger number of hunters. And when we look at the long-term WMA harvest, it's up and down. But when we put a trend line on it, our WMA hunters, at least on managed hunts, are more successful now. It's been increasing success through time. There was one anomaly in there, and that was somewhere, I think, around 2015. Where we just had an inclement weather year, not only for the Thanksgiving weekend, but the last weekend of October, which includes a lot of our Western WMAs. And needless to say, the managed hunt I worked, that particular hunt, I remember it, the trees were sideways and the little canopy we had to supposedly hide under, it had got blown into the trees. So that wasn't a good day for deer hunting. And it was that October hunt, it was the one of the lowest turnouts, obviously, and lowest success rates. So, but when we throw that trend line on it, it does reveal that, two things. It reveals that while the number of hunters on those wildlife managed hunts, I should say, are decreasing, they're becoming more successful through time. So there's fewer hunters, but they're going home with a few, more hunters are going home with a deer than past year.
Yeah. And I, you and I talked about it earlier, and I want to just hit on it real quick again. What used to be Red River, Three Rivers is now Richard K. Yancey. Yancey's efforts per deer weren't anywhere near what like Dewey Wills or Buckhorn or anybody else that's going to be over in that delta. And then I got to looking at Concordia Parish itself, and it's not even ranked in the total kills or kills per forested acre. So everybody around Concordia, yeah, and private land, and now, and you look at it, it's public land too. Is there something there? Is there something happening in Concordia Parish that can directly correlate to what these trends are showing?
Well, some of it's going to be tied to forest and forest management, habitat conditions on the ground. But another part of it is the amount of flooding and water that some of these areas have been impacted with. When we look at Richard K. Yancey, in 2015 and 2019 were actually both years at which we had late summer flooding. And that resulted in very low lactation rates, which just simply our measure for reproductive output. Doesn't tell us how many fawns were born. It's just an index that we use to compare from year to year. So it affected that WMA as well as many of the private lands in and around the WMA complex. So without a doubt, environmentally, those conditions aren't as good as they could be. And a couple of negative years in the last six certainly haven't helped. And it's not unique to there. We've actually seen, it's just not as significant, a little bit of dip in those bachelor lands along the Mississippi River to the north. But there's no WMAs there, so we're kind of just comparing those parish averages. And while they're still very impressive, they have actually dropped a little from where they were. But without a doubt, it's still going to be tied to habitat. And when you look at Yancey, last year it was 17.7. But in recent years, efforts per deer have hovered in and around 10. Mm-hmm. And that isn't that far off from long term. What we're seeing on Yancey is kind of a combination, but it's really the number of hunter efforts themselves is down significantly. So we have fewer hunters pursuing deer on that particular hunt. And then the landscape around it, it's changed. I mean, that forest has gotten older in general. Portions of that complex have been reforested and they're aging and advancing. The amount of agriculture that's interspersed in and around the WMA has changed. There's portions of the WMA now that are reforested habitat that gets flooded that was one time agriculture that would have been there at least in the summer months providing forage. So, all of those dynamics are changing. And but what is encouraging, looking at that WMA in particular, one thing that we do is beyond looking at harvest, we look at the habitat and we measure the change in habitat through browse index or browse surveys. And while we did see a pretty significant decline in browse utilization on Richard K. Yancey, as well as a few other bottomland WMAs, we pulled back on seasons. We reduced the number of either sex days. On Yancey in particular, we cut them in half, shortened the seasons altogether. While we recognize that harvest wasn't the culprit, it was changes in environmental conditions. You recognize that you still can't move along with the same harvest strategy if environmental conditions are changing, even if they're the catalyst for a decline. And what we've seen is the browse indices, at least upcoming last year, had improved significantly. So the outlook is very, very good. And Dewey Wills, which we made the change probably about a year ahead of Yancey, is ahead of schedule to the point now of where we're seeing browse indices, meaning browse utilization, that has literally doubled in the last 5 or 6 years, which just basically means you run a 100-foot transect counting plants along that transect. You're looking at the number of those plants that are browsed. In addition to that, you're looking at the percentage of preferred species, meaning the plants that are preferred or deer are going to select to browse first. What percentage of those are actually being browsed? And you're talking about some of those WMAs like Dewey Wills, like Richard K. Yancey. We've actually seen things double in a positive direction. So you're going from areas where you're seeing 7 or 8 plants browse per 100-foot transect to now where you're seeing the numbers up 15. And then you're looking at percent use of preferreds, where it was down in the 20 or so percent range, is now hovering in the 30 and 40%. So you're starting to see, at least on the landscape, on the habitat, where there's a response, where there's a shift, there's a change. And the importance of having transect surveys such as that and going back to the same locations that you went to 3 years, 6 years, 9 years before, it just gives you a relative comparison. You don't know how many deer are there. There's not really a practical way to try to estimate those numbers, but you certainly can look at what they're eating and how much of it, and if what's preferred, what percentage of that. And if you standardize your techniques like we have and utilize that through time, you can at least see what the trend is doing. So we did notice the trend declining, made some adjustments to seasons, but now more than anything, due to some environmental positives in the form of rebounding fawn crops that, you know, in better environmental conditions, and then with a more compressed season, we've seen things turn around to the point now as we're probably sitting at a where our browse indices have literally doubled in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And those are positives. And that's the importance of gathering that data, because it was only based on what we think or what we feel, then that's not going to do any good for the resource, nor the hunter that's pursuing the game on that area. It's very important to collect data that you can measure and put your hands on and actually put pen to paper and record actual numbers, and then see how those numbers are changing through time. And that's part of what we do, not just on WMAs, but with some DMAP clubs too, that level of assessment when it comes to habitat.
And so the listeners will know, when the state does the, you know, the tighter seasons, it's really, and I can speak for firsthand knowledge, when we lost Union Wildlife Management here in Union Parish, we were fortunate enough to lease some of that. We got in some of that lease land, as did some of our friends. I mean, I knew people from one end of that place to the other. That first year, brother, I can count on one hand how many 140-inch deer came off that spot. Mm-hmm. And there's no telling how many more were living on that spot that either got killed we didn't know about or were taken out elsewhere. After that, since it's been in with the seasons, it kind of fell back to what everybody else is. So it works. Okay, when these guys come in, I mean, my dad killed one. It was, and I had him on camera. I didn't hunt that day. He did. 141 and something, beautiful 10 point, you know, and it came right off the wildlife management the year after the state law, you guys gave up that? You had to give it up, or how did that go?
Yeah, we were, like on all of these leases, their leases are provided to us at no cost. And at that point, that was no longer available to us. So we lost it at that point.
Yeah. And that, you know, and even though I benefited from it, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, it hurt that. And I think Jackson Bienville was another good WMA that kind of got absorbed in
Northwest,
that.
Northwest, there's, you know, limited amount of public wildlife management area. There's certainly a lot of national forest land mm-hmm. in Northwest. But yes, from a WMA standpoint, we still do have, bodcaws fairly large. But when you're talking about right there in Jackson and Bienville Parish, as the namesake of the WMA was, there just wasn't a lot else, you know, for as far as public land for those hunters to go to. And look at Tech so close by, just the number of Tech students that were
exactly
flocking to there.
And yep.
Remembering back to my college days and the camaraderie I had with some of my, you know, fellow students, just going out and our classmates, I should say, just going out and making some public land hunts together. Mm-hmm. Those areas, they provide tremendous value to a lot of hunters.
Now let's go to what I like. Okay, with me being a deer scorer, I like the big game records. I look at the big game records like people look at other records, you know, the home run king or the whoever has rushed for the most yards in a career. And you almost know these names by heart. So last year we had some really good deer taken, and we had one that came in from 1939.
Yeah. We had a couple of stories that are for, you know, both from Northeast Louisiana, but the one from 1939, that Madison Parish buck had been taken legally. And, you know, at that time, I would imagine Boone and Crockett, or while it was in existence, or just recognition, wasn't what it is today. There was obviously no social media. You know, folks weren't sending pictures to their buddies on the phone. That deer was harvested, and it remained in a family home for many, many years. And the grandson, just this past year, from the urging of a couple of outdoor enthusiasts, including a sports writer, brought the deer forward to have it considered for entry into the Louisiana Records Program. And based on the information that was provided on the hunter and information from others that were associated with possession of those antlers through time, with good faith put into that, we by those folks, we went ahead and accepted that entry. And it is the largest typical now in the Louisiana record books at 186 and 6/8. So very, very impressive deer.
With my background, I had heard of this deer. And some guys over in that area said, there's a state record that, you know, they've told me that for years. And I never, you know, it never came to fruition. And never, you know, I'm like, you know, okay, it must not have panned out. And then sure enough, I look and here it is. I'm like, oh my gosh, they must have got that deer.
Yeah, it finally made it in. It was just a culmination, things came together. All these circumstances aligned to at least allow us to have an opportunity to view and review the records as well as the antlers and going ahead and accept it into the Louisiana Records Program.
Yeah. Now, the next one up was Don Broadway's deer, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? And that one was from like 1940-something, wasn't it?
Correct.
You know, do you think, and this is just me talking, you can say, you can call me crazy, you think we'll ever see the top deer?
Yeah, it's possible. It's highly possible. It would seem like it would have occurred. But I mean, those records, those specimens, that just goes to show you how tremendous they are, simply to be able to stand up for that many years. But they've had some that have come so close. There's deer I can think of, one killed in Avoyelles, that's a top five. It was really just one abnormal point. If it would have broken that off, it would be the new state typical. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about, you know, deer in our, you know, in more recent times that were just right there knocking on the door. But everything has to come together. Yeah. And whether or not folks can do it, whether or not there is an animal that can exceed this, certainly the potential is there. Yeah. It is the same animals living on the same landscape. It's just environmental conditions are very different now. And while folks are managing for older age deer, that in itself would seem like the magic, you know, that would be the magic bullet for doing this. That would actually be the thing to trigger this. But you have to realize is in many cases they're managing for older age deer, but you're setting your bar at an inside spread, maybe a main beam length, maybe a estimated Boone and Crockett score. If you think the deer is 4.5, then he's going to be a candidate for harvest, maybe on the property you hunt. And you look at the amount of refuge that deer have from people compared to maybe what they once did when they were not as numerous. Mm-hmm. Now they're pretty numerous, but so is the access to those animals. So they're occurring on these properties that are being intensively hunted. You have game cameras out that are monitoring these animals. How many potential state records were killed when they were 5.5 that were 174 inches? What would that deer have been at 6.5? Well, we don't know. It could have actually regressed. How about at 7.5? How about at 8.5? We don't know. It could have regressed. Who's going to pass up 176 inch 5.5-year-old, because that deer could potentially end up being a 190-inch 7-year-old. Right. May not be, and you may never see him again, and the animal may die in the off season from some wildlife disease. It could die, you know, so there's no guarantee that a hunter would ever harvest that animal. But you have that going on right now. So while we are killing a greater percentage of older age bucks than we have at any other time, they're being combed through pretty hard. And once they're reaching those exceptional measurements, you know, when they're hitting that 150 class and they're 4.5 or 5.5 years of age, they're on the hit list. And, you know, that it does make it a little challenging for what could potentially be a new state record to actually come to fruition.
And, you know, I've done some outdoor writing in my past, and it kind of irks me a little bit, you know, to see the headline potential state record on every flipping deer, because it's going to take a very, very, very special animal to eclipse. And I mean, Brendan Morris's deer he killed this year, that 275 that came out of Richland Parish, you know, when Cecil scored it for Buckmasters, it was over 309 gross. Now, when we say Buckmasters, that's not any deductions. So, and it's not with Boone and Crockett, with the state records, they have to have a 60-day drying period. So after all that's said and done, they tallied the score 275 and 5.8.
We did. I was actually able to measure that deer. I measured it along with the regional biologist out of Monroe. A lot of folks listening will probably know Mr. John Hanks. So both John Hanks and I are official Boone and Crockett measurers. And when the deer came in, we kept it long enough to photograph it well. And while we both worked on it, we taped up all the non-typical points, what would be typical points. We put marks on where we would consider the measurements to originate from. And then we sent those photos to Boone and Crockett, knowing that we could potentially have been dealing with a new state record. So because of that, you know, we're not careful with every deer that we score. We recognize, because of the uniqueness of those antlers and the difficulty in determining the origin of some of the points because of the complexity of the non-typical nature, that was, you know, it was just simply points coming off of points to where it was not as clear cut as 99% of deer that we measure. So there was a lot of time. We spent the better part of a day measuring that deer, getting confirmation. And once everyone was in agreement and we all felt good about it, it didn't seem so complex anymore. But that was one where you take your time, each point you treat it as it's the only point on the animal. That particular point you research, you follow the rule to the letter of that rule, no gray in between.
That's right.
And then when it's all said and done, that was the point, that was the measurement that we were able to come up with. And while it was not a new non-typical state record, it's the second largest non-typical ever harvested in Louisiana. And it would be certainly probably among one of the largest non-typicals harvested in the United States this past year for free-ranging deer.
I think it was. I was listening to a podcast from South Louisiana called Between the Tines, and they had his story on there, which is a great podcast. Those guys do a wonderful job. And I think that's what Brennan said. He said he pretty sure it was one of the largest whitetails taken last year.
Yeah, I wasn't able to confirm that. And obviously at the time at which we measured it, we were in the middle of what I call the collection of data season. So Boone and Crockett was still collecting sample, you know, so you would have to just be able to go back to that particular list for that particular year and see if any others had surpassed it. But it has to be among the highest, because most years there are very few, if any, that would exceed 275.
Oh, that's and I can tell you, you know, from one score to another, thank you for, you know, taking the time and making sure and getting it right. Because this is when you look at an animal like that, I've scored one out of Morehouse Parish that had more points than I can remember. I think it's 30-something points. You know, you look at it, and it's kind of like what you said. You know what the rules are. You find where your points, and you treat each little segment like that's the only one. And when you finish that, I would have to, you know, I'd score a little bit and I'd take a break, you know, a little mental break to kind of get and go back at it. And it'll take two, three, 4 hours on something, you know, when you so when he says a better part of a day, I 100% understand the, and it's stressful because, you know, like he said, you got a potential state record you're here looking at and you want to make sure you get it right.
Correct. Yeah. Both for the animal, the hunter, and the integrity of the records program.
That's exactly the I think that's the most important thing from anybody's standpoint. There's an integrity part. You know, I don't, when I score deer, I tell people, I'm not going to give you anything. You know, this is an integrity thing. So when somebody comes and has a deer measured by me, they know that I have given it everything I've got. And this is as close as I can get it. And, you know, if anybody that can't do that, you know, they don't need to be scoring deer officially, I suppose.
That's right.
But and you heard him talk about tape. What we would do is on the points, you've got so many. So some people say, well, where do I even start? Well, when you find the main beam length, then you start taking typical points, non-typical points. And you put tape, as you measure them, you put a piece of tape over them. That way, you know, that point has been scored and you can move on and get this. Is that what you were talking?
We actually use multiple colors of tape. And so we taped all of the non-typical points with a particular color, all of the typicals with a particular color, and main beam tips identified them and marked the end of the tape there. So you had no doubt of what each one was. And actually, as we would measure each point, we would then remove tape. And we obviously started with the main beams, then the typical points. And then once those were done, we started working our way through the non-typicals. But the color coding of the points allowed us to share those photos with the Boone and Crockett Association. So their chief's measurer over the records program, Mr. Justin Spring, he was able to look at those along with us, especially with today's technology and our phones. We're able to have him almost there with us. And the color coding that we use really was more for his benefit. Okay. So it was more easy for us to demonstrate what we were calling each particular point, whether it was a typical or non-typical. Mm-hmm. But what was very encouraging is once that one was taped up, he said, there's not a thing I would change. And that was a good thing. So
good.
All parties involved were all in concurrence, which that is what you know, so there's very little to leave for debate when all parties involved all came up to the same conclusion. And for each and every aspect of those antlers. So that was great. And that was good. And that was why it did take so long, because it was following the rules to that degree.
Yeah. Now, before we get off the trophies, I want to just say, you know, people are listening, well, if that's number two, what was number one? Well, James McMurray. I remember as a little boy seeing that, and it's just golly.
Public land buck. That one actually came from Big Lake Wildlife Management Area. Mm-hmm. So folks obviously are familiar with Tensaw National Wildlife Refuge and Big Lake WMA, certainly just a neighboring state land that abuts it, and that's where that great deer came from. And it's still it still holds that record. And not to take away from the deer that don't even appear in the record book, there's just a tremendous number of deer that are taken each and every year on properties all across Louisiana in every habitat type that really just exceed what folks were used to seeing from those properties, whether they were growing up, whether it's a grandson whose grandchild harvested a buck on their property. Just right now is actually the heyday. We often talk about the good old days, and they're certainly good old days from a lot of other of my hunting memories when it comes to more of us at the camp on the weekends, and you know, whether it was cousins and uncles up to the grandfathers, you had, you know, a few generations of hunters together, and the things we did, talked about, and most of the time had wrong.
Yeah.
We just didn't have the science to back but we were making sense the best we could out of what we were observing in the deer woods, but not really seeing the number and certainly the age of animals that folks in most of Louisiana are seeing now. So We're talking about age structure. Not every deer, obviously, is going to make Boone and Crockett, nor will it even make the Louisiana Records program. But there's certainly a tremendous number of older age animals being taken each and every year. And we kind of talked about DMAP earlier, but last year, looking at our DMAP harvest, I believe that was the first year that our year-and-a-half-old buck harvest was less than 10% of the antlered bucks. Mm-hmm. And when DMAP was initiated in 1981, those first few years, getting back to that known age harvest data, it was roughly 80-20, 80% year-and-a-half-olds and 20% two-and-a-half years and older. And we saw the inverse of that, and I don't remember the exact year, but it may have been somewhere between 2011 and 2014, just somewhere in there, it actually had gotten to the point of where it was 80% two-and-a-half-year-olds, 20% year-and-a-half. And that was that switch in DMAP. And talking just in DMAP in general, but certainly folks enrolled in DMAP aren't the only hunters and landowners or lessees managing for older age deer. It's pretty common across most of our state, regardless of habitat type. So yeah, lots of older animals being taken.
So we have finished up with a deer report. I want to talk a couple. You got a few more minutes to talk with me. I want to talk a couple of topics that are hot and heavy on hunters' minds right now. Number one, and brother, we're sitting here in my house. You know, you look out here, I got this nice backyard that I'm trying to grow this grass on. I'm having trouble. My friends, they know how big a trouble I've had. Brother, I can sit out here and hogs will come up in my backyard daylight. And I think I've shot around 10 during the daylight since June 1st. What can we do? What's going on, man? Hogs are really starting to get bad. Is that affecting deer hunting?
It is. And it's certainly affecting deer hunters and habitats. And it's not just deer, it's other wildlife. Whether it's competition for resources, introduction of diseases that are transmitted to other wildlife, all of those things can have an impact on the overall health and productivity of all animals, including deer. And we've just seen a tremendous expansion and then increase in number through time. This past year in our male survey, that was the highest number of hogs harvested in that particular survey. I think that number was roughly around 600,000. And that's just unfathomable when we start thinking about, you know, the harvest has just continued to grow through time, yet you're seeing continued damage, pigs accounting for not only crop damage, but, you know, residential damage to people's yards. Just as you had mentioned, they're pretty much everywhere. And the few folks in the state who aren't dealing with feral hog problems are lucky, and hopefully they'll stay that way. Potentially there's enough isolation, maybe a vast enough open landscape where there's a tremendous amount of ag acreage that separates those forested blocks, or whether it's towns or cities that are providing some buffering to where they're adjacent to. But there are very, very few properties in Louisiana that do not have feral pigs on them. And as y'all are probably all aware, you can trap them on private property 24/7, 365 days a year, and you can harvest them day and night. There's no bag limit. There's no season limit. There's no season. They're labeled as an outlaw quadruped, and as such, you can pursue them and harvest them any and every way. But we haven't been able to shoot our way out of that problem. It's continued to grow and develop through time, and What has to occur down the road, I really do not know. I mean, there's possibilities out there of toxicants that could be used in a controlled manner where they're delivered to the target animal, which in this case would be a feral pig. Those potentially could come aboard. Whether there's some other biological control, none of those I'm aware of or being researched to a point of where they would potentially be available. But, you know, Mother Nature sometimes has a way of correcting imbalances, and the potential for, you know, disease that's specific to them is obviously there because they're reaching critical or what you would consider, you know, an overabundance in many areas. And will that in turn, you know, will there be some type of self-correction from that? Well, what remains to be seen. But at this time, you know, just pursuing them and then taking a planned or measured approach to it isn't a bad idea. There's a lot of technology now for trapping, even for harvesting them at night with specialized scopes, but trapping with the smart, you know, tied to your smartphone with a camera that's sending that image and signal that allows you to hopefully leave that door open until all of those pigs go in. A systematic approach of where you're trapping one location and then you continue to move out from that. So if you're on a hunting club that's 5,000 acres, starting on a location in the hunting club and then expanding from there, trying to target the removal of sounders using a combination of trapping and shooting, you can carve yourself out a little bit of relief. Auburn, among others, has done some research showing that if you can remove enough sounders in an area, that while pigs will eventually come back into that area, you definitely do buy yourself some time. And if you're able to, at that point, if that effort can be continued beyond your reach by others, then you can certainly even provide further relief, both in the form of time and in area. So those are some strategies that you can try to employ. There's a tremendous amount of research out there. Unfortunately, that's an animal with a high fecundity, with a high reproductive output. They're able to compensate. They're very smart. They can become very educated as far as hunting pressure. So once you start turning the heat up, whether it's trapping or shooting, they get pretty wise to it. And that's kind of the importance of not haphazardly going into it. When you're trying to control an animal as smart as a feral pig in the form of trapping, probably best not to educate them with the trap that would only target to catch one or two animals and educate the others and make them more difficult to capture with something that could capture the whole sounder. So if you have some naive populations where you haven't had much trapping, while it is so tempting, and I've found myself in that very predicament where it's tempting to just put out the little round trap that we have, just any pig gone is one less, but having the discipline to say, no, we're going to wait and put in a trap that's going to utilize the camera technology that allow us to drop the gate at the appropriate time, probably in hindsight was the better choice, simply because the other was just going to remove a few animals and educate many animals, whereas the other trap allowed us to catch many animals and only educate a few, which then you're hunting. Your ability to shoot when you're trying to target one or two animals, whether it's an old sow that didn't go in, you know, you have a better chance of plinking her off, obviously, than a sounder of 15. So
right. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, bears. And I'm just going to be honest with you, we have promoted crappie fishing up here with Lake Darbonne a ton because of hogs and bears. We've got a lot of hunters that are like, you know what, I think I'm about to give up on hunting for a little while and start crappie fishing. And I don't want to see that hunter decline.
No, but certainly not. And you want the bear to be viewed as a resource or asset. And of course, you know, that view is going to come from their interaction and then the response they get, you know, not only from our agency, but in the form of dealing with issues or nuisances that they perceive. And the bears themselves, you know, they're doing obviously quite well, especially in parts of Northeast Louisiana. You know, they're thriving. They have been delisted. They were delisted in 2016, so that was a huge positive. Whether or not we'll be able to hunt those bears and when, that remains to be seen. But certainly, if and when they become a game animal, that could shift how some landowners view them and hunters view them. They could all of a sudden become a resource. But, you know, many of the problems folks experience in the hunting setting up, I've hunted where there were bears and just had to adapt my behavior to the bear. course, you know, sometimes as a hunter and adapting that behavior is easy, but you know, when you have to adapt your home life or things around your home and yard, it becomes a little more challenging because even a lot of those folks aren't hunters even, you know, obviously. Yeah. So, you know, just whether it's pet food, bird feeders, they're putting something out for the squirrels. They're kind of inviting those animals and getting them to stay around. And that leads to a whole host of things. Yeah, it's where we are in that process. I'm not really the best person to discuss simply because I'm removed from the latest in the form of yeah. management of the bear and in the form of what is the potential for them to become a state game animal. And there's certainly staff that are much well versed in that. Yeah. But that is the direction that we're heading in the hopes of, you know, a couple of things is certainly them being viewed by landowners and hunters as a resource. And certainly hopefully to maybe some of the more bears that are less skittish, that are more prone to interact or come around hunters, or, you know, would likely be some that would be harvested. So that, I guess, could help mitigate some of what people perceive as nuisance behavior.
Well, I tell you, if any of the guys that are doing the bear study want to come up here and get on some land, I've got plenty of buddies that would be like, come on. They'll take you because I've got one guy that says he's got a picture, and I haven't seen it yet, of a bear, looks like a boar, head high on his feeder, and he actually picks his feeder up like a wrestler, and he's like, you know, and I'm like, oh my goodness. So I mean, it's starting to wear on some people, you know. Yeah. You know, because of the, I think it's more the property damage than anything.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. And for a hunter standpoint, that it is difficult to, you know, to modify those behaviors, but it just at the end of the day, we're kind of talking about, you know, bears or in pigs earlier, and is the while the bears can cause some aggravations, we think about the threat to the resource, damage to property, crops, and the pigs, hands down, or just at a magnitude higher when it comes to those negatives. And hopefully the bears in time, you know, become, you know, if they're a game animal, maybe they'll be viewed differently by some. Of course, it's a very contentious issue, and it's not going to be any different here in Louisiana than where it's been in other parts of the country. And even this past year, there were states that are traditionally bear hunting states that are wrestling with policy on hunting bears. And it's while the public right now is actually very supportive of hunting, it's actually, when you look at the reasons they support it, you know, sourcing your own protein, you know, harvesting a game animal to feed your family, those are the high ranking. And then when you look at sport or trophy, not saying, because those are subjective terms, but folks are more likely to associate those with a bear hunt than the latter. Yeah. Than when you're talking about a deer. And so it's going to make it a little more contentious and less supported, and likely will be a pretty good battle, but certainly one that'll be had. Yeah. At some point.
That's right.
The day is coming.
Well, look, I appreciate you so much for taking time out of your schedule, coming by and talking today, because I've never heard any of this data broken down before. And man, I really, really appreciate talking with you today. The information that Jonathan shared was really good, and that trend was continued when the crew from Tiger Bend Outdoors stopped by. Y'all listen to Peyton McKinney, Brian Tucker, and Caleb Gates give you a quick and dirty about trapping hogs. So I got with Jonathan Bordelon. We talked about the hogs. We talked about what's going on in the state, and I wanted to get with the best hog trappers that I know. Tiger Bend Outdoors.
It might be the only hog trappers you know.
It could be. I don't know if I know any others that are doing what you guys are doing.
Well, we didn't expect to do this either.
So tell us about what you got into.
I'm going to say almost 2 years ago, Sterlington High School, I don't know if you know, but we made both of the ticket booths from our deer stand shop for Sterlington High School. There's a little girl there, Veda, that's got cancer. And Sterlington High School called us and asked us to donate a deer stand and told us Hog Boss was donating a hog trap gate. And I'd never heard of them. We donated, both of us donated, and they raised money for Veda. And then the next year, Scott Hall called us and Corey Gilbert from Hog Boss and wanted to buy some deer stands. Well, we had just started encountering hogs at our hunting club. So when they called back, I said, hey, how much is one of them gates? And they told us. And I said, well, let's just swap out. So we swapped out. And we walked around that gate probably for 6 months at our shop because I was just going to use it like a can of Pepto-Bismol. When we got sick at the stomach at the hogs at our stand, we was just going to put it out and see if we could catch one. Well, the last week of 2019, we finally put it out at Brian's deer stand, and we made our own pen because they have several options of what you can do, and we just bought the gate. You can buy the gate in the corral, build your own pen, or you can just buy the control and put on your own guillotine trap. So we went to Tractor Supply and bought 4 panels and 15 T-posts, and we put it up. New Year's Eve night, we throwed the gate, and the hogs got out because we didn't have it secured enough. We didn't know what we was doing. We had no idea. So we read some more, called Corey back, and said, hey, we messed up. So after that, we reset it, put it in another spot, and we caught our first bunch. We caught 23. And so we put them all in the back of our little Ford Ranger and drove to Marion, and it was like we had a 150-class buck or a 12-inch turkey bearded turkey in our back of our truck. Everybody in town was coming to us looking at them. Well, we had no idea that there was that many hogs. You know, we'd been getting them on camera, but we thought it was the same ones, really wasn't paying attention. You know, black and red hogs coming out, coming back and forth. We've caught 80 in that one spot.
Yeah.
We had no idea.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I've got some guys that I've been working with in Arkansas where I work, and they'll tell you the same thing. You think you may only have a handful, but when you get down to it, you've got probably 3 or 4 times as many as you think you have.
We got interested in it then, and we started doing research. In the state of Louisiana, says there's 700,000 hogs in Louisiana in the 64 parishes. If you start doing math on that, there's some parishes in the marsh that probably don't have any. So each parish has at least 10,000 in it. Mm-hmm. And as rural as Union is, we could have more than that because we've done call 500 in 16 months.
Yeah, 500 hogs. Jeez.
Almost in the city limits of Marion.
Yeah. Well, heck, y'all caught them down in Monroe. North Point. That's not quite – is that in the city limits of Monroe?
No, it's right outside the city limits of Monroe. But if you don't know where that's at, it's the new restaurant, Claudaddy's, Ludwig's Marine, which used to be Lynn John's, and then you turn into North Point Subdivision.
On Highway 165.
Yeah. Every house in that subdivision is probably $300,000 or $400,000, and we were set up right against – we had our trap right up against the back door of one of them.
Yeah.
We caught 10 down there last week. And actually, Ludwig Marine sent us a picture today and said that they have 12 rooting in the yard on the complex there where they sell them boats at, wanting us to come back down there.
Man. So, like, give me some tips. So let's just say, so you use the Hog Boss gates.
Yes. I like them. It's a local company. Local guys answer the phone. They're right here in Sterlington and Bastrop. The guys that own it live in Sterlington, but their shop's right there on 165 and Bastrop. We're probably helping 5 or 6 different people right now learn how to trap. Because there's several ways you can do that. We never knew that we were going to get this involved with that until we figured out that you could actually build you 5 or 6 gates and put on your hunting club. I mean, five or six pens and put on your hunting club and bait them. Leave an 8-foot opening and move the gate to each one as the hogs come to it. Or you could just buy a controller and put on your own guillotine gate. Or you could buy the whole corral, which is a 10-panel corral, which is what we have now because we got tired of driving T-post when it got up in July.
We drove a lot of T-post.
Really?
Yes.
But the COVID pandemic's really what got us starting in this because I got quarantined so many times working at the sheriff's office. I couldn't go anywhere. So I'd get on a four-wheeler, leave the house, find some hog sign.
And throw out your trap.
And I'd throw out the trap and drive some T-post. But I've caught 80 at my house and I only thought I had 12.
You've seen my struggles this year here, just right at my property, right here at my house. I mean, the daylight. And I have had, I know, 10 in the daylight in the yard that I have actually been able to shoot, and probably that many or more get away, you know.
Most people don't believe this, but this is actually the funnest thing I've ever hunted, and I'm a diehard turkey hunter.
Oh, yeah.
And deer hunter. But this is just like dog hunting for squirrels or rabbits or coons or whatever. All your buddies, we in a text message together, hogs. You know, we got the spy point cameras, and then we got the real links on it. So it starts dinging our phones, and even our buddies who are in our hunting club that don't live in Union Parish, some of them have access to our cameras, and it's just like they up here hunting, and they're happy. They monitor the hog traps from Baton Rouge or in New Orleans just like they hear in Marion with us. You know, you don't always have to be the one monitoring it. That's the good thing about it. And you can throw the gate from anywhere.
Yeah. That is, you know, Corey, how long has he been doing this, you know?
I think they've been at it about six or seven years now with the company.
I probably need to pull him in and talk to him just to get, you know, pick his brain, because this is, you know, I feel like, number one, his product is tried and true. I mean, we've seen that time and time again.
He has some set up at NASA. They actually on the grounds of NASA where the space shuttle is with hog ball straps.
Right here in the parish, right here in North Louisiana. I mean, we can, you know, it's a good thing. In my opinion, I feel like if, you know, I've heard some leases, they'll go buy a gate, they'll go get some panels, they'll set them up. And then the lease, you know, if one of them gets some hogs, be like, hey, let's move the gate over here and you'll catch them. And then, I mean, really, in my opinion, and you know, Jonathan even alluded to it, you know, the gate dropping system is the most effective way to remove the majority of your problem.
And you get the whole pounder. You're not just getting three when you dog hunt.
Right.
When you get, wait, you know, you ain't got to do it all one night. You wait till all the pigs come in. You see 12 on camera, you get 12 in the pen, you got them all.
And like when you do these other traps, you know, you get four or five of them, and those other four standing outside, they just got educated. They're not coming back in a trap.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's kind of what we were talking about. He said with one, what you're going to find is you'll catch one hog. And then with a gate, you get all of them. You know, you're educating them if you're just catching one. Now the other ones on the outside are looking like, I ain't going in there.
Where we're hunting at now, we've already caught pigs twice. We have three different sounders coming in. And you can tell the ones that were around, 10 pigs will come in and two will lay down outside the gate.
Really?
They know better.
Just lay down and not?
No, won't even look in it.
Wow. So tell me, you know, I got to see my first hog boss set up. I got to go to, I just riding down to going to work, and I happened to look over in Jerry McAllen's field, and I saw it, and I knew who it was. I knew it was out there probably, what, about 100 yards, 150 yards. And I knew. I said, Peyton and them. And I sent you that text, and you immediately said, yeah, I done had one. You know, he said, they already coming. And wasn't long after that, you caught. What's the average time when you catch?
Well, sometimes it's the first night, and sometimes like these we're fooling with now, there's three different sounders. There's supposed to be a bunch of rain and a hurricane coming in next week. I'm trying to get them two there at one time where we can catch 20. But it's 12 coming, 10 coming, and 6 coming.
What's the most you've ever caught at one?
23. While I had COVID.
Well, you had COVID. So you had to handle it?
No, me and him both had it.
Yeah, we was both on quarantine. So.
No.
Yep, in a pen.
Not, it's not wanton waste with a non-native invasive species like a feral hog. You can do with them what you want to. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah. We even went, we trapped 18 in a butterfly sanctuary over in Bastrop where the it's the native grass. There's a 40 acres there that biologists study the migration of butterflies and stuff before they were rooting up. The guy paid us to go over there and catch those 18 in that field over there. I actually called him last week, and he said he hadn't had any more come in since we caught those 18.
Yeah. And you know, you don't want to just go throwing them everywhere. You want, you know, put them where you, you know, some people bury them. Some yes. people do a lot of stuff with them that, that's going to get rid of them. You know, most, I guess you would say the way where it wouldn't invade in anybody else. You know, you want to make sure you're doing right by your fellow person. And
I done the math. We've caught 500 around, well, a little over 500. So there's no predators for feral hogs, and the survival rate of the small ones are supposed to be almost 100%, and they can have 2 litters a year. So if there was 300 sows in the 500 we've caught, I lost math within a year of 6,000 piglets.
Yeah,
that could have possibly. That's why the you know they're spreading so fast everywhere. I begin, you know, in the beginning, I thought, well, yeah, you know, we got 100 around Marion scattered around. This ain't gonna be a big deal. But we've caught those 500, and most of them's been within a stone's throw of the city limits of Marion on our way back and forth to our deer stand shop in Linville.
How many did you catch right behind Dollar General?
How many we caught there? 28.
At least. We had three traps there.
Ricky Taylor's got 12 right there, close to there, baited up right now that we're fixing to go on after we catch these.
We've caught pigs 3 times within a mile of Dollar General and Mary. And they're at my deer stand. And when I'm hunting, I can hear doors shutting at the store.
We seen 4 across the road here at your house the other morning going to put a deer stand up in Luna.
Yeah, I don't doubt it a bit. Yeah, you know, I thought I had them. And they'll come up, and I'll take out a couple of them, and you know things look good. And the other day I was cutting the grass, and I looked out there at the edge of the yard. And the thing about it, they'll come up to the edge of the yard because it's soft dirt. But when they get where Heath put that tractor, they won't root because it's packed. And they get out, and I said, "Oh my gosh, I got some more." So you telling me I got 4 right out here? That's not a shocker at all. I'm ready. Hey, them and them army worms. I'm ready for them, baby. I got a box of 22 bullets, and we'll go to popping.
But one thing we found out about, I mean, we self taught. This is not anything our daddy showed us or our buddy or, you know, it's all brand new. We watched a little bit of YouTube. I watch old Yalt out there in Mississippi a pretty good bit because he's pretty much the king, and then Barrett Chapman over toward Oak Grove in North Louisiana, he catches a lot too. But we mixing up some different feed. You kind of feed them a dessert. I've done learn. You feed them a little dessert every 2 days or day, and they know it's only a little bit in there. They'll all run in there and try to get that dessert. You know, they're greedy. But we've been mixing up cow feed with sugar and Kool-Aid. We use Delta Magic a lot too. We got some hog bait that Dwayne makes with Delta Magic. We use it a lot, and we pour it on there. You put a lot of corn in there, and you get them to coming in. But I like that extra little ice cream in there where they'll, because them that lay down, some of them will go on and come in there, but they'll get greedy and they'll all try to go in there at one time to get some dessert right off the bat instead of corn. Because, you know, I guess from August to January, corn's on the ground every 300 yards in Union Parish. So that's not a big deal. You know, that's like eating a hamburger anywhere. They're just a little bit different, you know. But if you get something in there that they seem to like, they'll all run in there at one time to get it, you know. And I think that's got a lot to do with why we're catching so many.
Yeah. Well, you guys, y'all got it figured out. That's for sure. Well, I think. I mean, I don't know what you think, but.
I don't know if we got it figured out, but we're starting to. More people's calling. I got like four people I say I'm quarterbacking right now that's calling the shop or calling us saying, hey, I got this out. What do I do? And we helped, I guess, three people today that sent me back pictures. They went and bought the Rio Link, or they went and bought them some type of cell camera and put on their trap. They actually built one, bought one. I mean, as long as they're trapping something, I think it's going to help the deer hunting population, because I can't put any corn or rice bran out behind my house last year, and I've done caught 80. So I'm hoping this year I can actually feed deer a little bit, because since the hogs moved in, I've seen less deer than I've ever seen in the 15 years I've lived there.
Well, I was talking to Gary Cobb the other day, and he told me one of his buddies that he hunts with, he feeds early August, starts in August, putting out, you know, corn and whatnot like that. Said the boy put up the feeder. Within 24 hours, I can't remember how many bears he had, and he had a passel load of hogs and zero deer. 24 hours, he had everything but the target animals that he's after. And I feel like it's going to take these gated systems, more and more of these gated systems, you know, more hunting clubs or individual lease lands or something. And people are going to have to start really, because you got to look at it. You threw out that number. What was it, 700,000? Mm-hmm. You know, I read a report where the state estimates we have, I believe, 500,000 whitetails in the state right now. We got more hogs than deer. Deer eat a lot of the same stuff. I mean, hogs eat a lot of the same stuff that deer do. So what that does, the more hogs you have, the less food supply for the deer. Now, the carrying capacity goes down. Now, your does are throwing smaller fawns and less fawns. That's just the way I'm thinking. I don't know that to be true. I'm not a biologist. But, you know, we're going to have to really buckle down, I believe, as a hunting community, and realize that this non-native species has a – we got to get this thing under control.
Well, that's the good thing about the trap. And I promote them, but I'm also promoting just build you some kind of trap and leave an opening – out there for some kind of gated system to go on. I prefer Hog Boss because we know the guys. They're down to earth. Something messes up, 20 minutes I can be at their shop. You know, not that I've had any problem with anything they had, but if I want to buy something else or something new comes out, I mean, we actually have three gates from them. And as they have more field testers and they build their company up, they're actually trying different things and building different gates and able to ship them overseas now. They're actually selling those overseas, catching other animals now. And we have one of those gates, and it comes in several different pieces where they can be able to ship it overseas. They're catching hogs overseas with those now and Hog Boss.
All right. So, you know, I love stories. Tell me the best story you got. Since you've been dropping gates, what's the best? You got a good story?
It was probably in the beginning, when they could almost get out. This is trial and error. You know, we put them up around, we caught 50 at Nathan Pilgreen's house in Dean, which if you know where he lives at, he lives on the corner of Upper Washita Refuge.
Yeah, because 50 ain't dropping the bucket up there.
We were using wire ties, and like I said, we were self-teaching ourselves what to do. Well, we caught 12. And, you know, we walked up to shoot them like Tombstone, you know, Doc Holliday and them. Well, when 12 hogs start pushing on a panel, I don't know how much force that is, but it was all big. Well, they tore loose, but they didn't know they were out. So we're trying to kill hogs that wasn't really in a pen, but they didn't know they wasn't in a pen no more. We were just shooting. And they're not that easy to kill. But we actually killed 5 of them outside the pen because they didn't realize they pushed the panel outside. And if they took a left, they'd all got out. But in the beginning, we didn't know how to tie them. We were using wire ties and those little things, you know, that come with a T-post and twisting them up. You gotta use some. We use U-bolts now. Because you can put them on a drill and just zip, zip, zip. We got 75, 80 U-bolts, zip, zip, put it together, it don't come apart.
So how long would it take somebody to put something like that together?
probably 30 minutes, 30, 40. But if you buy a corral system, you can get, you know, 10 minutes. If three of you knows what to do.
I've seen these corrals. They are. I mean, it's like prop them up, bolt them together.
We drop a pin.
Yeah, drop a pin, put moved in the next one. And I'm, you're just like, whoa. But, and they're sturdy. They're really worth the money, to be honest with you.
Caleb actually worked at Hog Boss for a couple months when he was between school last year. So he got to see firsthand who all was buying them. He drove the big Hog Boss truck and a trailer and dropped them off at all the Goldman's and wherever else they have business at. And he got to figure, you know, stopping and talking to people and telling them how they done it. And he'd tell us what was going on with them and how they done it. And we incorporated into what we're doing.
So it's basically just information sharing. Information sharing is going to lead to success.
A bunch of what I saw up there was hunt clubs coming together and buying them, you know, just all of them pitching in. And I think, you know, if we up here could do that, you know, we could really help our whole population.
I agree with that.
100%. We had people coming from Shreveport, you know, all over the country or all over Louisiana. You know, to pick them up.
Yeah, I mean, you get a group in together. You know, the system itself, you know, for one man may be, you know, good quite a bit of money, but you get a group of people in there together that are going to run this thing together, that are going to monitor the thing together and keep it upkeep and all this, that, and the other. That, you know, it's really a good investment. It's almost as good of investment as if you're going to lease the land, you better be prepared for hogs.
You could add $25-$30 to every hunting club member that, you know, in a 30 or 40 member club, and I, you know, come up with a gate or you know, the next year save it that year, and the next year get it, and you get a whole complete system. Yeah. But the best thing to do would be to go up to Tractor Supply or your local feed and seed store and get those 16-foot panels with the T-post. 7-8 of you get out there and everybody drive a post and block it down, and then put an automatic feeder in it with a camera on it. And then when you get it and if you got one gate on the club, you can move it around to 10 different places and catch 200 or 300 hogs right there in hunting season while everybody's at the camps. Because you're going to find 3 or 4 members in each club that love it like we do.
Right.
A guy asked me yesterday, he said, "You don't get tired of fooling them hogs?" I said, "Man, this is just like the first time I called up a turkey and he gobbled within 10 yards. I mean, it hurt in my chest." You know, we all texting back and forth at night going, "Come in, go out, you know, he just left. Where, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's one laying down. Let's wait on that one. Can you go in the morning if we throw the gate?" You know?
Yeah.
And if nobody could go, like, we had 12 going there Sunday night, but nobody could go Monday morning, so I had to let them walk. And then last night, we had 9 go in. We said, "Well, we had 12 Sunday. Let's wait." You know, so we're going to get them all. It's up to us when we go.
You go when you can go. You know, you don't go when, "Well, I caught hogs, I've got to go kill them." You know, you go when you can go.
Yeah, I mean, if it's impossible, they come in and it's impossible for you to go one night, you just, you know, "Well, I'm just not going to be able to do it," and you just wait because they're going to come back.
Exactly.
Do during the off season when you can't hunt, you can run your cameras, you can see the hogs. You know, everybody's, like I said, everybody's talking about it, texting back and forth. "All right, we can go tomorrow. Let's get them. Take off."
Yeah, that's cool, man. I tell you what, I think I'm really going to start pushing for more of this from our members, especially, you know. So, because it's needed. You got to have it. You got to do it. Yeah, he's blowing up over here. Man's popular. Phone blowing up. But you, like you say, I mean, it's trial. It's trial and error. I mean, you've got to have the right people involved, you know, that are fired up. And of course, like Peyton was saying, it probably doesn't take a whole lot for somebody to get involved in it.
Find out, hey, this is pretty fun, you know.
Yeah.
This is real enjoyable.
Cool.
You ain't seeing nothing hunting, you know.
Right,
exactly.
We caught 22 at a chicken farmer's house. Or chicken farmers, chicken houses a few weeks ago. You don't want me to say no names, but you might have seen the pictures. But anyway, the the chicken company was actually panicking because the hogs were rooting up against the chicken houses. So when we caught those two different sounders there, the chicken farmers had no idea. They couldn't believe they was actually that hard to kill in the pen. You know, they thought we was going to pull up there, pop, 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 and go to the house. Well, they bouncing off the whole time, bam, 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 bam. We let them dispose of them. And they decided they needed a little more target practice before next time.
Yeah, and that's another, you know, you want to make sure you're doing it the right way. Yeah. You don't want to go in there and half-cocked and just start, you know, because I've seen it take place before, and there's a definite difference between those who know what they're doing and the ones that, you know, like you said, need a little bit more target practice.
You talk about trial and error. When we first started, it was at my deer stand. I had people at the house, hogs, 8 hogs in it, dropped the pen. And we had spy points at times, sending 1-minute pictures. 1 minute had 8 pigs in it, and the next minute there was no pigs. The gate was sideways, and the back of the pen was blown out. So that I had tie wire and zip ties, and that was no match. The next one we had had some reinforcement behind it for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and you want to do that. You want to make sure that you've got what it takes. But there again, I mean, it's you kind of have to, and that's where the knowledge and talking, like Peyton was saying earlier, but he's being the quarterback, that helps out a lot. You know, you can cut down the learning curve is significantly easier for somebody. You know, now that they're talking with you guys than what, like, y'all had. I mean, y'all probably didn't have a whole lot of people to bounce ideas off of, right?
I mean, just like when I started turkey hunting, I mean, I don't know how many trips I made to Joe Pickle and Gary Dial's house, you know, because they were the king of the turkeys, you know.
Oh, yeah. I saw some turkey the other day. This is no joke. I saw some guys doing a turkey calling competition. First person I thought about was Joe Pickle and that gobble he used to do. Man, that was right.
I remember when he passed away, we were out of town deer hunting, and somebody called and told me I got weak knee. You know, I everything flashed before my eyes. He'd ever taught me, because I'd go by there and go, okay, Joe, listen to this. Burk, 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 burk. And he said, let me go out the house and get mine, you know.
Yeah.
And I find myself, you know, I'm like, we're not calling deer. I mean, calling turkeys, but, you know, we're trying to educate people before we don't have any deer or turkeys left to hunt. Because, I mean, those hogs are eating a bunch of turkey eggs, too, because they're out in fields, and there's 15, 20 of them out there going across them at night. They find in a nest. I think that's why I don't have any at my house. Killed one gobbler there in 15 years. I used to have 7 or 8 flocks of turkeys there, and there's none now.
Yeah.
And nobody's cut any timber around there.
Very well could. I mean, if that's the thing that's changed, that's you know, it's all points. You know, it looks like it's could be possible. Could be possible. Well, guys, I appreciate y'all coming by tonight, man. It means a lot. I appreciate y'all. I really like this. I may get y'all to come back later on to kind of talk a little bit more. I may try to get Corey in here, too. That'd be fun.
Me and him we're supposed to do a podcast in southern Missouri in the next couple of weeks. For the same thing, he's gonna get on there. It's gonna be a conference call, but we're gonna do one in the Ozarks.
Man, that's good. And you know, that's the thing I've said for a long time. You know, it's one thing to have hogs in this area, but when hogs get to where they're growing crops for the not only the nation but the world, now we've got a significant issue. And
one thing I've noticed, and I ain't figured this out yet. We hadn't caught a hog. Well, we've caught one. We've caught one hog that we could have mounted with big tusk. You know, we get, once we put that pen up, those things are way smarter than a whitetail or mature gobbler, I guess, because they go away. And we got a couple of buddies we'll call and tell them, hey, we left a boar here, you know, and the guys with the dogs go in and kill them. But they don't come around the trap very much. The big boars, you know, with the 3 and 4 inch tusk. We ain't caught one of those yet out of 500. And I see Eric McPherson's done killed 70 or 80 right there around Marion with his dogs. And he's got 7 or 8 good ones. Yeah. We ain't caught one yet.
And that was something else I meant to ask you and talk about was, you know, do you catch the big boars that's got that?
We don't catch the big sows, but I've got some scent and some, you know, some hog and heat we put out. And I caught some up in Tuckertown right outside of Marion one day. We caught the big 300-pound boar with some big teeth. But we had scent pads out. And I think he just came at night and said, hey, something's weird here. Let me go in here and smell. And I was watching. As soon as he went out of the gate, I throw the trap, you know. That's the only big, big boar we've caught. He was 300-something pounds.
Well, I appreciate y'all coming by. There it is, folks. Everything you'll need to get ready and make a plan for your upcoming season. I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode, and please be sure to spread the word about this podcast. Thanks.